Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the conference call on India Budget 2017, Implications for International Business. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Rajesh Simhan. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. And hello and welcome to this webinar on the India budget for 2017-18. And I welcome all the participants, both from the East Coast and the West Coast. So when we look at the budget for this year, one of the key things, again, turmoil over the last few months, both in India and also internationally. We've just gone through a whole demonetization exercise. We've had a situation where we've had changes which have happened as far as some of the treaties India has entered into, whether it's been in respect of Mauritius or with Singapore. Internationally, you've had a situation where you've had a new election in U.S. You've had a new president whose idea is really to put America first. And there is a lot of protectionist measures which are currently being envisaged. So it's really in this backdrop that we are really talking about a situation where a budget has been presented. There have been concerns which have been raised in the last, especially by the foreign investor community. There have been concerns that have been raised on application of general anti-avoidance rules. There have been concerns around the indirect transfer tax or the Vodafone tax, as people still tend to call it, in terms of some of the clarifications which have been issued by the tax department. When we look at the budget this year, what we really see is a mixed bag. You have a set of changes where the finance minister has tried to address specific concerns which have been raised by the investor community. These concerns have been primarily around issues relating to the indirect transfer tax, and there have been a few other changes which have been there on things like conversion of preference shares. But what we also see is that there are a number of anti-abuse provisions which the government has introduced this year. Some of these anti-abuse provisions have their basis in the base erosion and profit shifting analysis which the OECD has been carrying on over a number of years. Some of these anti-abuse provisions are geared to essentially look at specific transactions. Unfortunately, one of the things that we've seen is that this may also end up inadvertently affecting most of the business community, which is there. There are also a significant degree of policy changes or policy announcements which were made as part of the budget. From a foreign investor standpoint, I think one of the key proposals which sort of came in as part of this budget is where the finance minister announced that the Foreign Investment Promotion Board, or the FIPB, will stand abolished, or there is a move to abolish it during the course of the year. Historically, when the FIPB was set up, there were a number of sectors in India which were actually regulated sectors. What we've seen this government do over the last couple of years is that they have gone towards liberalizing most of these sectors. Or in a few sectors, what they have essentially done is to say that they will be, the approvals will be given by the specific regulatory authority, be it IRDA or the Reserve Bank. And as long as it's coming in within the regulatory purview of one of these authorities, then there is no need for actually having the FIPB review. I think the move that the government has really done is to say that at this point in time, more than 90% of the sectors have been liberalized and are open for foreign investment. The idea here is to say that, listen, we are going to be liberalizing the rest of the sectors also, so that and there is no real need for having a FIPB at this point in in time. There is also a new foreign direct investment policy which is supposed to be announced. The government is in the process of getting stakeholder representation before they sort of pass the policy. But in light of some of the changes which have happened and the liberalization which has happened over the last couple of years, they didn't really feel the need to continue with the FIPB. So we still need to see how it's sort of going to work out in terms of the few sectors which are still sort of being regulated sectors. But this is definitely one step that they've again taken to say that we are open for foreign investment. The second set of policy sort of changes which they've also announced is around listing of security receipts and listing and trading of security receipts. In the Indian context, traditionally you have asset reconstruction companies which have the ability to buy stressed assets through specific schemes of trusts which are set up. And there is still, and most of the investors who are actually subscribed to these security receipts are foreign portfolio investors and in some cases even certain classes of domestic investors. But one of the challenges that have been there that has been observed over the last few years is the fact that there is a lack of depth as far as the distressed asset market is concerned. In the absence of there being enough participants in the stressed asset market. So the government has made certain policy announcements whereby they have now allowed for listing of security receipts. There will be rules and regulations which will be put in place to allow for this. And what we are essentially going to potentially have is a situation where that even as far as distressed debt is concerned, you're going to have a potential trading mechanism for these. But coming back to some of the key tax changes, I think one of the things that was on top of investor minds, especially during this budget, was around the indirect transfer tax or the Vodafone tax. Historically, back in 2011-12, the government had made certain changes. They had tried to tax essentially the Vodafone transaction, which was a sale of a foreign company shares, which foreign company held shares of an Indian company to another foreign company. At that point in time, there were no provisions that were there in place. The government introduced provisions with retrospective effect. The matter went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court sort of held in favor of the tax, saying that no tax is payable. But the government has, over a period of time, sort of put in a legislation essentially to say that if you're a foreign company whose value is derived substantially from Indian assets, and substantially in this context is more than 50% of the assets are from India. In that case, even if there's a sale of shares of the foreign company, that can still be brought within the Indian tax net. There were concerns that have been raised in the past also as to whether this can potentially lead to a multi-layered taxation, whether this can lead to a situation where there is a lack of foreign tax credits which can lead to a rise in transaction costs. There have been concerns raised around availability of treaty benefits. So in this context, the first thing that the government had done was introduce rules as to clarify what is meant by substantial, how you sort of allocate values, how you sort of allocate gains. And there were also certain stringent reporting requirements which were brought in, including reporting requirements on the Indian portfolio companies. The challenge around this was also in terms of the classes of investors who would have been affected by these provisions, because the way the provisions essentially read was that even if you had a small minority interest in a foreign company which exceeds 5%, if the foreign company shares derive their value from Indian assets or substantially from Indian assets, that would have been brought within the tax net. The government had also constituted a committee to look into some of the issues posed by the indirect transfer tax provision. The committee came up with certain suggestions and a report, and based on which the government had issued a circular in December. Unfortunately, the circular resulted in creation of more issues for foreign investors. and there had been various representations which had been made before the finance ministry, and in light of which they had actually withdrawn or kept the circular in abeyance. But what the government has tried to do is at least address some of the concerns which had been raised by various market participants, be it foreign portfolio investors or the private equity investor community. I think, Mansi, I would sort of turn to you now to sort of explain in terms of what the government has really done and how they've tried to address some of the concerns raised by foreign investors.
Sure, Rajesh. And as you rightly said, we've been seeing updates or movement on these provisions for the last 5 years now, when it was initially introduced in 2012. And yes, I think we are relatively in a better position from where we started, just because they've managed to at least quantify, you know, importantly, they've at least given an objective test for what substantially is. So although, like you've said, a lot of the issues still remain outstanding in terms of number of, you know, the exceptions that they've carved out or question of credits and applicability of treaties and things like that. But what they've done, you know, if you focus on this budget, essentially, I would say that the changes that they've proposed has still not, I do not think they solve all the issues that revolve around indirect transfer. So some of the points that you had mentioned earlier, I think, will still remain outstanding. But the limited benefit that they've given in this budget is with in relation to the redemptions or the movement of cash up the chain where there has been a transfer or a sale of investments by the entity that is directly holding Indian investments. So to just explain that more, the way the law was drafted, it was wide enough that in case there is a sale by the entity of an direct sale by an entity of an Indian investment, the cash proceeds, when they are distributed up the chain, if the mode of distribution is not something like dividends and rather a share buyback or any sort of redemption which entails a transfer of any share or LLC interest, for example, or a partnership interest, that could potentially trigger the indirect transfer provision, which was very frankly a very unintended consequence of these provisions, because as we know, the original, what they were really going after was Vodafone sort of situation where indirectly you were transferring Indian assets. But they did not carve out the prerequisites. They did not carve out enough in balances, and these transactions were getting, you know, there was a risk that indirect transfer provisions apply to them. Now, in December last year, so December 2016, They had been getting a lot of questions on these, and there was, as you said, there was a committee that was set up. So there was expectation that they would be issuing some sort of clarifications on the applicability of these provisions. In December, the circular that they issued was very disappointing in this regard, because it was a simple, in a Q&A format, where they had taken a very technical interpretation of the rules, and they had not acknowledged the fact that what they were saying could result in levels of taxation. In fact, even taxation, for example, in the case of FPIs, which are legitimately exempt from tax after paying SPP on long-term gains, in spite of that, if they were moving cash up, there was potential that you could trigger indirect transfer. So the circular, of course, caused a lot of unrest, and there were a lot of representations made to the government, and which the government, to give them some credit, within a few weeks acknowledged the problem and kept the circular in abeyance, which was good news. And so the expectation was that this is not the end of it, we will hear something. At least they've realized that there's a problem of multiple taxation. What this budget has announced now is that they have carved out a limited exception for certain investors. So what they've really provided is that investors who are directly or indirectly holding an interest in a foreign portfolio investor, which is a category 1 or a category 2 foreign portfolio investor, those transfers are not going to fall within the scope of indirect transfer provisions. So which is definitely a positive step. However, they have not gone all the way, and that is a very disappointing part, because they have bifurcated between the kind of investors. They have only given this benefit to Category 1 and Category 2 FPI and their investors. And they have left out Category 1, Category 3 FPI. And of course, they have not considered PEVC investors. What is interesting is, that in the budget speech, the finance minister had actually referred to both of these. He had said that I've taken care of the foreign investors in FPIs, and he'd also said that where the sale of Indian investments has been chargeable to tax, in that case, the redemption for other investors as well will be out of the scope of indirect transfer provisions. But one, of course, it's a questionable what chargeable to tax really is and how they'll draft it, because though he said it in his speech, the fine print actually doesn't contain this exception. It only talks about the FPI exception. So, of course, the expectation is either they'll include it, in the bill before the act is passed, or there'll be subsequent circulars which will be talking about it. But yes, one of the crucial issues will be, Rajesh, of how they're going to deal with the whole chargeable to tax issues, and whether they'll look at, any sort of restructuring, exceptions for restructuring, mergers and things like that, which again, should not be resulting in double taxation.
Yeah. Thanks, Mansi. And I think one of the fundamental challenges here is that you are always going to have situations which will not be provided for, because you are looking at hundreds of different permutations and combinations which are really possible, especially in a fund context, where you have a private equity fund which has been set up offshore in terms of how their interstate relationships with the LPs are, how their structuring of their investments into India are, that there are going to be multiple different situations which, unfortunately, at least based on the kind of clarifications which seem to have come out from the finance minister, both in terms of the proposed amendment and the proposed clarifications, may not necessarily address. So that's definitely, I think, one area of concern that is going to continue. And I think the second one, which also, and again, there has been a lot of discussion around it, especially for private equity and venture capital investors, because one of the requirements which the indirect transfer provisions actually contemplated was that even the Indian portfolio company would have to maintain records and documentation in respect of any transfer of any interest throughout the chain, which would have effectively meant that the portfolio company may have been required to even maintain records relating to any transfers by limited partners in a fund, which generally, as in if you look at any documentation today in respect of any investment, you have confidentiality restrictions, and no private equity investor really would want to disclose to their portfolio company even in respect of LP composition or any LP redemptions or transfers. So that's definitely, I think, one area which is going to continue to be a big issue. I think just moving ahead in terms of the next possibly significant change is where the government has sort of looked at the issue relating to conversion of convertible preference shares to equity shares. Traditionally, when you look at private equity investment into India, a large chunk of the private equity or VC investment has come in by way of convertible preference shares. And a limited extent probably through convertible debentures. One of the challenges that was traditional, while there was an exemption that was provided as far as convertible debentures are concerned, in terms of a conversion of a convertible debenture to equity share, in which case the historical cost basis and the historical time of acquisition would have been taken into account. No such specific provision was provided for conversion of convertible preference shares to equity shares. And in fact, we have seen in the past there have been different interpretations which have been taken by courts and tribunals, where the Supreme Court has taken a stance that the conversion of a convertible preference share to equity share would be treated as a taxable transaction and taxed the fair market value at conversion. Whereas you've had certain tribunal rulings which have come up, which have relied upon certain departmental instructions, to say that the conversion of convertible preference shares into equity shares would not be a taxable event. The issue also sort of got magnified, at least in the last couple of months, because of changes to the tax treaties which India had entered into with Mauritius and with Singapore, where effectively there was a grandfathering provision which was there, which said that if any investments were made till 31st March 2017, those investments would continue to enjoy the capital gains tax exemption under the Singapore Treaty or the Mauritius Treaty. But if an investment was made post that, they would either enjoy a reduced exemption or would not be entitled to an exemption, depending on the time of sale and the limitation of benefit provision. One of the issues that was there because of these treaties was the fact that if there was a conversion event which took place post 1st of April 2017 of preference shares into equity shares, the benefit of the treaty would not have been available as far as the equity shares issued were there. And people were always wondering, should we convert, should we not convert? And I think the government has tried to bring in some clarity, at least as far as the domestic tax law application on conversion. And Mansi, to you, in terms of the changes and how you think that will sort of, how investors will probably look at the issue of conversion?
Sure. So let me just explain a little bit more about what the current law is, and then I will get into what changes they've proposed. So currently, in case of CPS, as Rajesh had mentioned, there has been ambiguity about the conversion triggering tax. So while the law has, the way it's drafted, is unfortunately unclear, there have been conflicting, you know, decisions from the court in this regard. So there could be two approaches that someone may be taking. Essentially, that you convert your preference shares and you treat that as a taxable transaction. You pay tax on the fair market, the difference between the cost of acquisition of these convertible preference shares and the fair market value of the equity shares that you receive upon conversion. And accordingly, you get a step up in basis. When you sell the equity shares that you acquire, you use the new basis, which basically means you use the FMV, which you had relied on at the time of conversion, and your holding period would be from the time of conversion. So what that really means is that if you're trying to get a long-term treatment, because usually in most cases long-term is going to have a beneficial rate, you'd have to hold after conversion the equity share for a longer time. But the benefit would be that the cost or the gain, for the purpose of calculating the gain, the cost would have received a step up. The other option or the approach that we were seeing really was that people were not treating the conversion of CCPS as a taxable transfer, and you essentially pay, you basically pay the entire tax at the time of sale of the equity shares which you've acquired upon conversion. So the cost would go back to your CCPS, and you would also get the period of holding. However, even though there were these two provisions, the law was drafted very, it was very unclear, and in fact, it would recognize the period of holding going back. However, it was not, the step up in basis was not clearly drafted. So you could be in a situation where you even treated the conversion as a taxable transfer, but you were, you know, the increase in cost could be challenged by the tax authorities. So basically, there was a lack of clarity on CCPS. In contrast to that, the conversion of CCDs was much, of CCDs was much clearer. The conversion wouldn't be taxable. At the time of sale of the equity shares, you would look back to the period of holding and the original cost of acquisition of the CCD. So what they've proposed in this budget is treating the CCPS very similar to the CCDs. So they have clarified the tax treatment of these convertible instruments and put them at par, which in which if you just look at the change, is definitely welcome, because you know, the clarity is always welcome. So it's a positive change in that sense. However, what it, you know, the main issue that it raises is what Rajesh was referring to, is with respect to the treaty changes, amendments that we've seen over the last year. One of the questions that all the investors were thinking about was essentially, what is the right time for me to convert? Should it be before 31st March or should it be after 31st March? And the reason being that your investment, the grandfathering benefit that an investor was getting, was specifically in relation to shares acquired prior to 1st April 2017. What that really means is that if for any reason you get shares after 31st March 2017, it would not be grandfathered. So, as such, the conversion becomes, the timing of the conversion becomes extremely crucial, because you could convert prior to 31st March and then you get the shares that you receive, they would be getting the grandfathering treatment. However, investors, to a large extent, did not want to be pushed towards, you know, a speedy conversion, and they perhaps wanted to hold on to the CCPS. In that case, if you convert after 31st March, the date of acquisition of those shares would be after the new treaty comes into effect, which essentially means that the shares would not be grandfathered. Any subsequent sale of those shares in such a case then would result in capital gains. But now with this clarity, with this positive clarity, in fact, has resulted in a case where that sale would, in fact, look back to the period of holding. So, which is a good fact, because you could easily reach long term, but there would be no step up and you'd have to go to the original cost of the preference shares. So essentially what that really means is good change, but definitely, you know, people will need to rethink their strategy now that there's clarity as to when they really want to convert these CCPS if they've invested from Mauritius or Singapore.
Thanks, Mansi. I think, so obviously people are re-looking at their strategy in terms of conversion to see what is the timing at which the conversion should happen and how that sort of works alongside probably the investment agreements that they've entered into. In terms of some of the other, there are at least a couple more changes which at least affect the transfer and or acquisition of securities. I think the first one is really in respect of listed securities. Traditionally, the rules as far as listed securities were that as long as you sold it on the stock exchange, paid securities transaction tax, and it was long-term in nature, you always enjoyed an exemption. What I think over the last couple of years, one of the things which the government had sort of noticed, and this is something that had been looked at by the Securities and Exchange Board of India and also by the tax authorities, is that especially in some of the small scripts, people saw that there was a lot of price manipulation, or there were a lot of people who were trying to get a tax arbitrage by either buying shares outside of the stock exchanges and then selling on the stock exchanges or vice versa, and undertaking cash transactions to sort of in respect of spread of differences. And as an anti-abuse measure, the government has sought to introduce a new provision to say that if you're selling securities or shares on the stock exchange and you have paid securities transaction tax, even though it is long-term in nature, it can still be brought within the income tax net, or the exemption would not apply if such securities were bought after 2004 and no securities transaction tax was paid. In effect, what this means is that, let's say if you have a situation where you had bought the shares outside of the stock exchange, could have been a preferential allotment, could have been a rights issue, could have been a bonus issue, any of those circumstances, the company has gone public or the company was already public and you sold it on the stock exchange, the exemption from capital gains tax would not be applicable. While this was an anti-avoidance measure, the finance minister also sort of has clarified and said that appropriate clarifications will be issued to ensure that genuine transactions don't get caught within the tax net. And the genuine transactions, he's sort of spoken about the IPO fresh follow-on offering, preferential allotment, those kind of situations. The challenge that is really there is that we, at this point in time, don't know what are the kind of safe harbors or clarifications which would come in. Because, but you have a blanket provision which is now has been introduced, which essentially says that if at the time of acquisition you are not paid securities transaction tax, at the time of sale, even though you it's a sale on the exchange and you pay securities transaction tax, you're still subject to a long-term capital gains tax benefit. Now, especially from private equity investors or VC investors, this is a huge significant sort of change unless there is an absolute clarity which sort of comes in that they are not going to be affected in the sense that any pref allotment or any bonus issue or any rights issue which they have undertaken in respect of acquisition of shares of these listed companies, those will still be available for exemption. So while at this point in time, the provisions themselves seem to be really harsh, only we just need to wait and watch to ensure that at least the clarifications which the finance minister has promised sort of comes through. The next point, which I also again on acquisition or disposition, which probably is relevant from an investor standpoint, is the whole concept of tax on notional income. Traditionally, at least in the last 5 or 6 years, there have been provisions in the Income Tax Act, which provide that if you have acquired securities at less than fair market value, the difference between the fair market value and the acquisition price can be taxed in the hands of the recipient as income from other sources. Fair market value generally has been looked at as the book value of the company. There has been a lot of litigation that has been there, especially in respect of investments in startups in terms of secondary sales which have happened. And because of this litigation, in fact, there have been a lot of representations which have been made before the finance ministry for sort of redacting these provisions, saying that it was essentially meant as an anti-abuse provision but has been applied more extensively. So the expectation, at least prior to the budget, was that there was a hope that, you know, the provision would be redacted. Instead, I think what we've really seen is an expansion in terms of the provision, along with introduction of other provisions, even in respect of sale of shares at less than fair market value, and the concept of tax on notional income. So, Marcy, again, to you, in terms of how some of these changes to sort of delve into it and how it's probably going to affect from an investor standpoint.
Sure. I think the issue of taxing notional income was these provisions are being added in the law. Over the years, we've seen a lot of movement in this side. For example, the tax in the hands of the recipient was initially introduced sometime in 2012 in a limited way, and then we saw the scope and other provisions being added in 2013. And now what they've done this year is expanded the scope immensely, which basically means that as a foreign investor, at any point in time, if you're getting shares, if we speak of shares right now, if you're getting shares at less than fair market value, there could be a tax in the hands of the acquirer, which could be taxable at the maximum rate under Indian tax law. But in addition to the changes in relation to tax in the hands of recipients, Rajesh, they've also made changes with respect to the transferor or the seller. So what the new change that has been introduced in the budget basically provides that for unlisted shares, if the transfer has been carried out at less than fair market value, even if the transfer has been carried out less than fair market value, they are going to take that fair market value as the consideration received by the transferor. What that really means is you could be selling it for lower than fair market value, but to calculate your capital gains, they're going to take the fair market value into account and accordingly reach a gain. So essentially what they're trying to ensure is that any transactions under fair market value, both the recipient as well, so the acquirer as well as the seller, could have a tax on this notional income. The seller is actually not receiving that consideration but having to pay capital gains, and the acquirer is paying less, and at the same, and in spite of paying less on the spread, they're going to pay that additional tax. So these provisions were sort of included as anti-avoidance, but we believe they are not taking into account the fact that there could really be commercial situations or justifications why parties are transacting with each other at less than fair market value. They have not acknowledged that, and they're forcing it. In effect, penalizes parties for transferring shares at less than fair market value, and is sort of forcing them to undertake the transaction at that amount. And I think it is not operating as an anti-avoidance anymore. If they wanted to do that, they could have, the scope should have been narrower, and they should have carved out special situations where they were seeing a concern, as opposed to widening the scope of Section 56 and introducing this new provision about taxing the transfers.
Sure. Thanks. And I think one of the challenges that's going to be there is that even situations like a distressed sale, where you're potentially selling at less than fair market value, or situations where in a distressed sale context, where it's an asset-heavy company, but you're actually selling it at less than book value, or in situations where, and today we don't even know how fair market value will be computed on sale transactions. But the challenge that is going to be there is that even genuine transactions are potentially going to be caught within this net. So I think at least, especially from possibly distressed funds or special situation funds, this can actually have a significant impact. So while at least those are some of the changes that that have been proposed, as far as securities are concerned, or shares and securities are concerned, there have also been a bunch of changes when it comes to what you would really look at debt investments into India. I think the first one is really what is a positive change, which is really extension of lower withholding tax rates in respect of Indian denominated rupee bonds that have been issued by Indian issuers. There have been a couple of changes there. One is that in respect of non-convertible debentures which can be issued by Indian corporate, they have extended the time period for the lower withholding tax of 5% to till July 2020, to essentially say that if any coupon has been paid on these non-convertible debentures, a lower withholding tax rate of 5% would apply in respect of those payments, subject to certain conditions being prescribed as far as the limits of or the percentage on the coupon payment. The second set of changes which they also introduced was the so-called masala bonds, because traditionally you had non-convertible debentures and which were rupee-denominated instruments, and you had external commercial borrowings which were generally treated as dollar-denominated instruments. The government a couple of years back had also introduced the concept of dollar-denominated external commercial borrowing, which could have been issued outside of India. And essentially, that was to sort of what you would call globalize the Indian rupee, so to say, where they allowed for special provisions, which allowed for these masala bonds to be issued. The government back in 2015 had announced that the withholding tax rates in respect of coupon payments on masala bonds would be 5% withholding. They were supposed to have brought it within the finance bill 2016 when they introduced, but that was one of the omissions that they had done. So this year they sort of corrected that to say that with a retrospective beneficial effect from 2016, any coupon payments on masala bonds would be taxed only at a beneficial rate of 5%. And similarly, what they have also done is to sort of ensure that they are broadening the depth in the bond market to say that any transfer of rupee-denominated bonds from a non-resident to a non-resident would not be subject to any Indian capital gains tax. So the objective very clearly from the government standpoint is to say that, well, we are encouraging debt investments. We want to broaden or increase the depth in the bond market. And to that extent, they have tried to sort of, A, provide certainty and extend the benefits at least till 2020 to say that coupon payments on non-convertible debentures till 2020 will be subject to the 5% withholding, and masala bonds issued till July 2020 will be able to get the benefit of the 5% beneficial withholding tax rate. But one of the things that we always that we see from this budget is that what the government gives on one hand, they take it from the other hand, because what they also try around are thin capitalization rules. Traditionally, India never really has thin capitalization rules, even though there have been challenges that have happened with the tax authorities from time and again, sometimes it's not really a dead instrument. But courts have generally favored the form of the transaction. The general anti-avoidance rules, which the government had formulated and which is supposed to apply from 1st April 2017, also had provisions which allowed the tax authorities to recharacterize debt as equity and equity as debt. But you never really had a specific thin cap rule that was there in place. And I think this time around what the government has done is to introduce thin capitalization rules, which they've tried to model in on the action plan 4 of the base erosion profit shifting exercise which the OECD has done. Maven, to you, in terms of how the thin cap rules they've proposed, how it actually works?
Sure. Thanks, Rajesh. So, as Rajesh was mentioning, this is basically a provision that's being implemented based on action plan 4 of the OECD Plus project. Now, what the form in which it's being implemented in the Indian context is that there is being a cap imposed on the amount of interest you can claim as a deduction each year. And that cap is 30% of the EBITDA of the company for that year. Now, while this is consistent with what the OECD has recommended, we have seen a lot of other jurisdictions also follow a slightly different route where they sort of control the ratio between the equity and debt in a company. So they don't want to see over-leveraged companies for many reasons. So the idea is that they want to prevent companies from indulging in what is called earnings stripping. So where you instead put in more debt into the company to get the money out through interest payments. Now, and that is sort of why it has been capped at 30% of the EBITDA in the Indian scenario. Now, while this may be following Indian standards, the problem arises when the way the associated enterprise has been defined in the Indian context. Now, to take a step back again, what was actually being targeted by OECD in Action Plan 4, where related party transactions, in the sense that let's say you have a group of group entities, and usually in a global structure there may be some entities which perform treasury functions, and they may be providing interest at a higher rate to indulge in interest earnings stripping. But in our case, associated enterprise has been defined so widely that even if a lender who's a third-party bank has more than 51%, if the loan provided by a third-party bank ends up being more than 51% of the book value of the assets of the company, or even if one particular bank provides more than 10% of the total borrowing, they would be considered an associated enterprise. Now, there is no reason why a third-party bank will indulge in this sort of practice by providing a loan at an extremely high rate, such that you take the earnings out through an interest from a high-tax jurisdiction into a low-tax jurisdiction. So these are issues that are going to affect this space. And this will particularly affect highly leveraged companies, which most likely have like a small margin and high capital expenditure, most likely in the real estate space. It's not very rare to see companies being leveraged 5 to 6 times of their equity in the real estate sector. And this will particularly affect InvITs and REITs and probably even delay them by about 6 to 8 months. Now, the overall picture is that while the government has been making the right move in the last 5 to 6 years and trying to deepen bond markets and everything, but with the single move, they're sort of set the clock back, because this will really affect all transactions, and the appetite for investing through debt will, I think, go down after this.
And I think one of the other challenges is that especially when you have project level loans which are probably given, you invariably end up providing a loan for more than 51% of the book value of the assets, you end up being a related party. Yeah, even on situations such as, let's say, not even a guarantee, but let's say a parent entity has given a comfort letter to a bank based on which the bank has given a loan, potentially come within the thin capitalization rules. So I think while they have tried to follow the best action plan code, I think there were inherent challenges which were already present in action plan code, because the moment you're talking about EBITDA of a company, if you're a cyclical industry, you're going to have profits in some years. If there's a downturn, you're going to have significant losses. So essentially saying that merely because you're a related entity, we are not going to allow you to take deduction of loans, even if it's on an arm's length basis. To a certain extent, it's a bit unfair, but I think, and even from an acquisition standpoint, the idea is always that even if you're looking at doing a leverage buyout or if you're doing a debt push down structure, you now have to sort of take into account one more sort of animal, so to say, in terms of some of the considerations that you look at as far as structuring for investments are concerned. Again, sort of changing the topic slightly. So while we've talked about equity investments, we've talked about debt structures, I think the other sort of community which is also there is the startup community. And again, last year, the government sort of launched the Startup India with the intent of sort of ensuring that there is a significant sort of investment which comes into the startup community. Of course, last year was also unfortunately one of those down years for startup community because the investments in startups sort of came down some 60-odd%. The government has also, while there have been many different proposals which have been sort of presented or represented with the finance ministry in terms of what can really be done to make the startup community more vibrant, the government has sort of plugged a couple of points in terms of giving a couple of concessions to the startup industry. Maybe again, in terms of some of these concessions and how it will probably have an impact.
Sure. So the couple of changes that the new budget brings, which is a good thing for the startup community, is that one of the biggest claims has been recognized by the government, which is that, you know, the earlier losses could not be effectively carried forward by startups into future years, because the way the provisions were worded is that any company could only carry forward losses if the shareholders were substantially the same at the time of both incurring the loss and claiming the loss. Basically, if the shareholding fell less than 51% of the original shareholders in the company could not claim the loss. Now, this was particularly difficult for startups to satisfy because startups are loss-making in the first few years. But 5 years, 6 years down the line, they turn profitable. But by that time, you had like a few rounds of investment, and the shareholding of the original shareholders during the CDA round or the actual founder have become so small that it tends to fall below the 51% threshold. So startups could not actually use the losses from the previous years. So what the budget has done is this is a problem and has said that for startups, they will be able to carry it forward. As long as the original shareholders continue to hold the shares they held at the time. But so even if a single share is sold, then this exemption can be lost. But as long as the shareholding remains exactly the same, even though the dilution may still occur, they will still be able to carry forward the loss. That's the first change. The second change is actually an extension of something that was introduced in the last budget. In the last budget, the startups were given the option of claiming exemption from income tax for 3 consecutive years out of a block of 5. This was to help them basically to promote startups. This was found to be a little impractical because like startups do take a bit longer than that to become profitable. So, and practically not many could actually claim the exemption within the first 5 years. So it has been extended to 7 years now. So they can claim it for any 3 years. The consecutive years within a 7-year block. Now, while these are moves in the right direction, there are many other outstanding issues that have not yet been properly addressed and which we were hoping that the budget might do something about. One of that is sort of related to what Rajesh had mentioned earlier, which is again the 56th issue, but a different subsection which deals with issue of shares by startups to angel investors, etc. So even then, if the shares are issued at more than what the fair market value as prescribed or as computed under Section 56 is, that would be taxed as income from other sources. Now, difficult proposition for a lot of startups, because at the point when a startup goes to an angel investor, the person has an idea, and it's more or less, how do you justify it? You can't justify it on book value, which is one of the prescribed methods, or even on a DCF method. Many times, when you're sitting across a table and talking to an angel investor, there is nothing more than a plan. There is, it's very difficult to actually practically say, this is my cash flow, and this is what I expect in the future. It's like a commercial understanding saying, okay, this is what I believe what the business is worth, and they come to an understanding. So ideally, this should not be there for startups, because otherwise you're effectively taxing investments. This is something that affects all of them, and that's not yet been resolved. The other couple of issues which is doesn't find mention in the budget is the equalization levy. Now, this is just to give a very brief background. If a startup spends any money on obtaining online advertising services from a foreign service provider, a 6% tax is charged on it. Now, most likely the foreign entity who was supposed to have actually paid this tax for that particular transaction is going to sort of push it down to the startup. And this will affect them, because about 40% of the budgetary expenses by a startup is on online advertising, because that's how they get customers, that's how they get valuation based on number of customers they have. So this, in addition to the GST, may lead to a potential 38% impact, because GST could be a 18% plus 6% for the equalization levy, which is a huge hit for startups. And nothing has been done in that regard, except senior officials have commented that the equalization levy may in fact be expanded to cover other services, which is not a move that is in the right direction as far as startups are concerned.
Thanks, Mia. I think there's just a couple of points around startups, especially around issues relating to Section 56 or even Section 68, which is income from undisclosed sources. Because one of the challenges that we've seen over the last couple of years is the fact that even when shares have been issued at significantly high valuations and you have a subsequent down round that sort of happens, we've had situations where the tax authorities have come back and challenged the down round or challenged the initial high valuation, saying that you have essentially the down round, the shares have been issued at less than fair market value. So those are kind of problems which some of these companies sometimes grapple with. And similarly on classification of issuance of shares as income from other, from undisclosed sources, because they've essentially said that, listen, you seem to have gotten a large primary fundraise. We don't know who the identity of the shareholder or the source of funds, and therefore we want to bring it within the tax net. In fact, this was one of the points, at least in the last few months, with a number of notices which seem to have suddenly gone up. Pretty much every single VC has at least a couple of companies in their portfolio which have sort of faced this problem, and they were really hoping that some relief could be provided, and doesn't really seem to have. I think the last couple of topics which I do want to sort of dwell on before we sort of open up the line. The first one is on general anti-avoidance rules. General anti-avoidance rules, again, the draft rules first came out. It was first proposed back in 2012. It kept getting postponed. I think as of last year, they sort of deferred it to 1st of April 2017. There was a lot of talk whether it would get extended, not extended, but I think what the government has really done is sort of put their foot down. They've said that, yes, come 1st of April, the general anti-avoidance rules will come into place. A couple of days back, right prior to the budget, the government came out with a circular sort of clarifying on some of the queries raised in respect of application of the general anti-avoidance rules. I think, key issues or concerns which sort of brings about. The first one being that today, in terms of application of the general anti-avoidance rules themselves, whether it is an all-encompassing provision which can even override something like a specific anti-abuse rule or even a LOB provision or a limitation of benefit provision in the tax treaty. The government has sort of come out and said that, listen, while we have introduced or there are specific anti-abuse rules which are there in place under the Income Tax Act, the general anti-avoidance rules sort of act as an overarching principle. So even if, let's say, in a particular situation, you're fine as far as specific anti-abuse rules are concerned, the general anti-abuse rules can still be extended. The second one is that even as far as treaty situations and LOP is concerned, even in those situations, there are circumstances which may still give rise to a general anti-avoidance rules application. The third critical or important change or suggestion or issue that is there in respect of the general anti-avoidance rules is that while you have general anti-avoidance rules which are there, under the tax treaties which India has entered into, you have limitation of benefit provisions. Apart from all of this, you also now potentially have a multilateral instrument, which is really, again, a consequence or a result of the OECD BEPS report, where they have essentially come up with a draft multilateral instrument, which countries can sign up to. And the multilateral instrument also has certain limitation of benefit provisions, which include a specific business purpose requirement, even as far as entitlement to treaty benefits are concerned. And I think one of the issues or concerns which is sort of there is that the business purpose test, which is sort of there under the general and under the multilateral instrument, is even more expansive than the general anti-avoidance rule. So the issue that's going to be there is how do you sort of reconcile the two of them together, and under what circumstances potentially anybody would be entitled to a treaty benefit. Once countries sign up to the multilateral instrument, it is expected to be signed up in July. India is also expected to be a signatory to that. I think a significant number of Indian tax treaties will also probably change as a result of that. So I think purely from entitlement to treaty benefit and application of general anti-avoidance rules, that's always a matter of concern that's going to be there. The circular which the government introduced also clarified to say that the ability to general to apply GAR rules even can be there in situations such as a merger or a court approved scheme of arrangement if the courts have essentially not dwelled or gone into the issue of tax avoidance. So I think at least in terms of application or the scope of the GAR rules, I think the government has sort of come in and said that it's going to be as wide, and they're not going to put in any fetters or limitation as far as the application is concerned. But I think the way that they've also approached it is to say that we are going to put checks and balances, or we do have checks and balances in place, to say that the GAR rules, for it to be applied, there needs to be a special panel or committee which actually has to look into the case to approve even for the tax authorities to proceed with invocation of the GAR rules. Additionally, they also have to take the permission of a retired High Court judge who will be appointed to sort of oversee, to ensure that there is no abuse of power as far as invocation of the GAR rules are concerned. Again, these are the whole introduction of the GAR rules is something which I think most investors are worried about. At least until we see how it sort of works in action, if the government can sort of come out and sort of show in the first couple of years that they are, then it's only going to be applied on outlier sort of cases and exceptional cases, I think that would be a lot more comforting. But I think come 1st of April, I think the rules of game effectively change. So that's one, I think, big other change that's come in. Again, another aspect which the government sort of brought in right before the budget came in was also changes to the residency rules when it came to corporates. Traditionally, India always had a control and management test, whereby for a foreign company, it would be treated as a resident of India only if the whole of the control and management was located in India. A couple of years back, they decided to move into a place of effective management test, to say that even if the place of effective management is in India, a foreign company would be treated as a Indian company. There were multiple concerns that were raised. So the government had decided to postpone the application to 1st of April 2017. The main challenge, and especially it comes up a lot of time in the fund context, when you have India-based GPs who have offshore funds, whether the offshore fund could be treated as a resident of India. It came about in, also in the context of Indian MNCs who had operations outside of India. The government sort of also came out with a set of guidelines right prior to the budget in terms of how they're going to view the place of effective management. May I again back to you in terms of how the tests are sort of, how the government has sort of looked at the tests.
Thanks, Rajesh. So I will not be going very much into detail, but just to give a very broad overview on what the new guidelines have stated. It's basically, they reiterated what the old guidelines, the draft guidelines issued last year stated while clarifying a few more areas of concern. So as it stands right now, the test is twofold. A, they will first see whether the company has any active business outside India. Now, otherwise, what will happen is they will look at what, where the actual key commercial decisions are made. So if the active business is deemed to be outside India, then it will be presumed that the company is resident outside, so long as the majority of the board meetings occurred outside India. Now, to decide whether active business is actually conducted outside India or not, there are a few parameters. For example, like 50% of the employees should be outside India, or 50% of the total payroll expenses is incurred for people outside India, etc. Now, broadly speaking, there has been a big move away from a very objective test of residence to a very subjective one. And this is where, during different points in the clarification, you see that the way they go about it is, if you don't meet the active business outside India test, then you look at different factors to see whether it's the shareholder really making the decision. Is the management actually making the key managerial decisions, or are they just standing aside and is someone else deciding with only implementation being done? So it does lead into a lot of gray areas. Now, luckily, some aspects have been clarified. For instance, if shareholders are exercising any rights under company law, then those will not be considered to be effectively making any key managerial decisions. And key managerial decisions of themselves have been decided to mean anything but operational decisions, which would include day-to-day management of affairs, running the company, and may more relate to opening a product line or, you know, doing away with a certain product, etc. What is also interesting to note is that the clarifications have come in just before the budget was issued. And this test is already applicable for the previous financial year, and the data that will be considered to see whether 50% of the employees were in India or not, or for the active business test, will actually be the average of the data from the previous 3 years. So that leaves us in a position where, you know, companies really did not have any choice as to how to structure their business. And tomorrow they may wake up and suddenly you are resident in India and you have to pay tax. When you've already discharged your tax liabilities for being resident in another jurisdiction. So we do sort of expect a lot of litigation in this space, and it would have just been probably better to have instead stick to the older rule of residence and have a GST concept instead.
Yeah, and I think one of the challenges that is there is especially on something that is subjective in nature, considering the quantum of litigation and how aggressive Indian tax authorities have been, it always poses a bit of a challenge. We've seen similar challenges come up even in terms of corporate inversions or slips, where I think companies now have to sort of go back, relook to see whether their structures sort of work now. So I think on an overall basis today, when you look at the budget, I think while they've tried to address some specific concerns, but plethora of sort of anti-abuse provisions and the sort of perception which they've sort of looked at to say that, you know what, we think that a lot of investors or whether SECs are indulging either in aggressive transactions or illegal transactions. Therefore, we want to put in anti-abuse provisions or multiple anti-abuse provisions in place. So that's sometimes a bit concerning, especially in terms of perception. But having said that, as I said, on an overall basis, I think the challenge that's going to be there going forward is that we are now looking at not just two or three different issues, but probably 5 to 6 different issues when you're looking at any kind of deal or any kind of structure, and even how you investors will look at issues like risk allocation or in terms of what structures may work and what may not. But I think broadly, I think those were really some of the key changes. While there have been other changes on transfer pricing and a few other changes, not really that sort of material when compared with some of these bigger changes. But with that, I think I'll sort of open the line for the audience.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handset while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Participants who wish to ask questions may please press star and one at this time. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one.
So if there are no other questions, I think then we can sort of close the webinar.
So would you like to give some closing comments, Mr. Rajasimhan?
So I think, as I said, thank you for participation. Hopefully, we'll see at least in the next few months how things sort of pan out. But again, thank you all for participating.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Associates, that concludes this conference call for today. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.